The Science Inside Podcast.
This is the Science Inside.
Good evening and welcome to the Science Inside, bringing you the latest news stories and events happening in the world of science, technology and innovation. I am Nondumiso Luhutso and my co-host Linda Gutletimakwe will not be joining me for tonight's show, but I will safely guide you through this hour and there are interesting things in store for you tonight. The 1st of December is commemorated as World AIDS Day. This year's theme was Ending the HIV and AIDS Epidemic Community by Community. A study conducted by the United Nations indicated that 7 million people in South Africa are living with the virus. Now South Africa has been working towards turning the HIV, AIDS and TB for quite some time, and we would like to investigate what kind of progress has been made at least during the past 5 years. So on tonight's show, we want to find out more about the newly discovered HIV subtype and what its implications towards diagnosis, treatment, among other things may be. And on Science this week, we look at how the development of a new toilet can become your own personal doctor. Then finally, we unpack what the impact of the dolutegravir drug will be. It is said that it will be the drug that could change the course of the country's fight against the epidemic. But right now, we go into the news with Bridget Lepere.
This week's Science Headline.
In your news-making headlines this week, e-cigarette smokers are susceptible to chronic risks of the lung and cardiovascular system. And new research sheds light on risks of HIV factor in kidney transplants. Good evening, I am Bridget Lepere. A preventative cardiologist at the University of Wisconsin, James Stain, has called on medical science teams to assess the impact of e-cigarettes, commonly known as vaping, across the world. Results have shown that e-cigarettes, initially designed as tools to help cigarette smokers to quit, have in fact resulted in widespread use by young people who were initially non-smokers. The e-cigarette is a battery-operated device that contains nicotine and substances that dissolve the nicotine and flavorings. Popularity rose approximately 5 years ago as a result of flavoring options and enhanced methods that imitate smoking. 13 million people in the United States are estimated to be e-cigarette smokers, a number which is more than other people worldwide. Now, earlier this year, hazards emerged when a number of reports on acute lung injuries began to strike. U.S. cases now approach up to 2,300 with a total of 47 deaths. Medical oncologist specializing in lung cancer, Peter Shields, reported that these cases are nothing like the characteristics found in the cases of e-cigarette smokers. Health officials have suggested that injuries are linked to a vitamin E oil that contains tetrahydronal cannabinoid, known as THC, added to e-cigarettes. Studies in animals have already shone light on the long-term effects of e-cigarette use. In September this year, a paper in the Journal of Clinical Investigation described the results of mice being exposed to e-cigarettes for 4 months. A graduate student, Matthew Madison, showed the results of the animal's lung tissue, which displayed an anomaly within immune cells called macrophages. A further experiment revealed that macrophages not only help to protect the body from infections, but also recycles lung surfactant, which is a mix of proteins and lipids that coat the inside of lung air sacs and AIDS gas exchange. Solvents in the e-cigarettes have been proven to not only dissolve nicotine, but to dissolve anything that comes in the way of the user. Although the mice seemed healthy, once exposed to the flu virus, their macrophages died, suggesting that their ability to fight infections had actually weakened. Another concern is whether, like smoking, vaping can potentially lead to cancer. Scientists of the belief that e-cigarettes are likely to be less carcinogenic than tobacco. However, a team of New York University School of Medicine have reported that mice that were actually exposed to e-cigarettes for 54 weeks had an increased risk of lung cancer and showed changes in bladder cells that are indicative of cancer. The consumption of cigarette smoking and e-cigarettes, respectively, delivers hosts of chemicals that are absorbed across the lining of the lungs. Concerns for non-smokers have been taken up the habit, as well as of smokers who try vaping to quit their habit, remain as both forms use nicotine. The long-term risks of e-cigarettes to health are still yet to be determined. And in our final news story for tonight, a study looking at the impact of the second HIV strain, which is transplanted with kidneys, has shown a high survival rate of recipient patients with no resistance to the drug regimes. South Africa has one of the highest incidences of HIV in the world, with 7 million people in the country living with the virus. Over 10 years of 51 kidneys from deceased HIV positive donors have been transplanted into HIV positive patients. The study found that after 5 years of their transplants, about 84% of patients survived, while close to 80% had a functioning kidney. The study also looked at the impact of the second viral strain. Although it is not advisable for patients with HIV to get exposed to a second viral strain, donor viruses disappeared from their systems 12 weeks post-transplant in all cases except one. In this one case, the donor virus was undetectable at 26 weeks post-transplant. The cases in which South African patients whose transplanted kidneys failed after a few years was identified as reoccurring HIV-associated nephropathy in the transplanted kidney. This means that despite a good control over the virus, that there might be a viral reservoir in the kidney that has not been reached by the entry retroviral treatment. However, another clinical issue for patients in the exceptionally high rejection rates, which require a strong induction of immunosuppression. Studies have shown that rejection happens when the recipient's body recognizes the kidney as foreign and tries to disable it. In general, transplant patients need drugs to prevent this process due to a dysregulated immune system. On the other hand, induction therapy makes recipients vulnerable to opportunistic infections as the patient's CD4 count drops dramatically because of the treatment. In the transplant patient, there is a fine balance with keeping the patient's immune system strong enough to fight any infections and not reject the kidney. It took most of the recipients in this study months to recover their CD4 counts. This meant that they needed ongoing therapy to prevent opportunistic infections and tuberculosis. The use of HIV-positive organs is now a well-established practice in South Africa and also part of the ongoing HOPE study in the USA. Positive results showing little impact of the second viral strain are warmly welcomed in this work. The introduction of a second viral strain is not a clinically sufficient or significant issue for this population group. However, this makes the procedure a safe long-term option for patients with HIV. Recapping your stories for this week, e-cigarette smokers are susceptible to chronic risks of the lungs and cardiovascular system, and new research sheds light on risks of HIV factor in kidney transplants. That was all from me. But what do you think about this new study on HIV and kidney transplants, Ndumi?
I really do think it's interesting. I mean, for me, I've never really considered the degree to which, you know, transplanting can have an HIV. The HIV factor has never really been something that I was aware of.
Yeah.
So I do think it's something that is interesting and that we also need to become aware of.
Yeah. But I really like the fact that where they are saying that actually after a couple of months when they had actually transplanted this kidney to the new donor, the donor actually didn't recognize the new HIV strain that was introduced into their body. So I think the body is truly an amazing organ, don't you think?
I do. I really do.
Well, that was all from the news desk. Over to you, Ndumi.
Let's go into Unscience.
This week's Science Headline. This is the Science Inside.
So listen, you're still with the Science Inside, and we're going to switch it up. We're going to give you a young story before we head straight into Unscience after the interview that we have for you.
My name is Angela Mazusi. I'm 31 years old. I'm a person living with HIV. I am by profession a nursing sister. Currently, predominantly, I deal with treating ART patients and TB patients as well. I run the TB program at the facility that I work in. I was diagnosed with HIV in 2011. I hadn't been feeling well for some time, but I had very vague symptoms. You know, one could easily mistaken them for a flu or a fever, you know, or something like that. But it was actually HIV symptoms in very early stages. So what I had was lymph nodes around my neck, on my groin area, and they were not visible to the naked eye. So lymph nodes are like little growths, little balls. They're around my neck and on my groin and under my armpits. And therefore, I went to the doctor, and then the doctor investigated me for HIV via the normal blood test called the ELISA test. And then after that, the results came back negative, and I actually asked the doctor to conduct a more conclusive test. He conducted a PCR test, and it came back positive. And that is how I was diagnosed with HIV. Initially, in the initial stages, it was very difficult. It was hard to accept. I went through depression. I was very depressed. I had suicidal ideation. But in the ultimate end, I looked for help. I saw a psychologist. The sessions really, really helped. And I got better from then, you know, because actually, above everything, the one thing that pushed me was my love for my children, because I thought, okay, fine, I've been diagnosed with HIV and I'm feeling suicidal. But because of my HIV, does it then mean that my children have to go through life without a mother, without my love and without my guidance? And therefore, I really literally had to pull myself towards myself. And yeah, I started, you know, learning more about the disease. I changed my work environment to work in an HIV space. And that is how I grew in HIV management. To start with, nurses are human beings. Secondly, not everybody is infected with HIV because they're promiscuous. You know, that is what we need to understand. Mm-hmm. And that is how we are actually going to get rid of stigma and discrimination when it comes to HIV. And thirdly, being a nurse actually helped me because I knew what to do. And especially at the time of my diagnosis, the first test was negative. I think if I wasn't a nurse, I was just going to let it go and say, okay, it's fine, I'm happy, I'm negative. But I knew there was something wrong with me. I knew that further investigations had to be done. And therefore, being a nurse actually helped me. But however, my observation with the other nurses, all people in the profession, doctors even, is that a lot of them that are diagnosed with HIV tend maybe to have negative perceptions about themselves. Because sometimes, remember, stigma starts with the self. There is what we call self-stigmatization. They start stigmatizing themselves. I know from when my days in school, in college at Vara, a lot of our colleagues would die from HIV. Even when I was now a professional nurse after I had graduated, and we'd always wonder why a nurse is dying. We should be having the knowledge to say this is how we treat HIV. But you can recall, I mean, if you think about it, you know that HIV is, you know, has got a lot to do with the mind. So if the mind is not right, then the physical, you know, the physical aspect will not be right as well. And that's why I feel a lot of sisters in the profession have actually died because of self-stigmatization. I disclosed my status openly back in 2014 on a TV show. And part of disclosing for me was I needed to take my power back. I wanted to take my power back. And what do I mean by saying I needed to take my power back? So I had disclosed to a couple of friends, and friends were telling friends, and, you know, the news was spreading. My current partner's ex knew about my status, and, you know, they were telling everybody who cared to listen about my status. And at that point, I felt, you know what, this is my story. I know my story best, and I need to take my power back. And part of taking my power back is actually telling my story the way I know how to. But then it grew. It now became about helping other people after the initial stages, because after I spoke out, a lot of people actually came out to say, hey, we're also living with HIV. Hey, we're also undergoing this, you know. And then as far as disclosure to my family.
So that was a story by Angela Mutusi, who was explaining how tense it becomes when one experiences or finds out, rather, that they are HIV positive, especially in our society, South Africa. Bridget, what is your take on how our society handles people who are infected with the virus?
Well, if I would just, you know, reference from what Angela was saying, I think her story is a very powerful one, because it just shows that, you know, stigmatization, as she had mentioned, that is still a very big problem in South Africa, right? Where she said, you look at yourself in a certain way, you perceive yourself in a certain way, you look at yourself as if, you know, you are redundant or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that also obviously affects your self-image, how you portray yourself, how, you know, your confidence, basically. So what you are saying there is that actually, when I spoke to her, she was saying like a lot of her colleagues were dying because of stigmatization, where even though these people are doctors and nurses and they deal with this virus on a daily basis, they are the ones pricking people's fingers and telling them that, hey, you've contracted this virus. But I feel like it's a bit of a shame, because if you are undergoing cancer treatment, you can freely say that, and people actually feel for you. And another thing that actually came out from our conversation was that, you know, she's saying that, you know, with HIV, why does HIV have to have that factor, right? Why do people have to, you know, feel it, that kind of way? Because it is actually, she was saying, it's actually linked to promiscuous sexual behavior, yes, or you are immoral, you don't have, you know, morals. And that is not true, because some people are born with HIV, and you can actually get HIV from one encounter. Mm. And it could be from one person that you had just slept with, and there was your partner. So, I mean, these are important conversations that we need to have. And in order for us all to fight HIV, and as much as with new drugs that are being delivered or rolled out, it is problematic if people still don't look after their behavior, because behavior is a big thing. It's the key ingredient to actually actively fighting HIV.
No, I do have to agree with you, because even when you go out there, you know, it's more of the fact that there's an idea, as you mentioned, around you have, if someone has HIV, it's the stereotype that, no, this person, there's no way they were just born with it. Mm-hmm. They were doing something. You know, and you did say that cancer doesn't have the same
stigma,
the same attitude. Like, yeah. no one, you know, no one will say that when someone gets cancer. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to HIV, it's this mental indoctrination that, no, that you can't just get HIV.
Yeah.
And it's just very sad in our society. I don't know how we can find ways to teach, because even from a young age, as children in primary, it's even there, when you find out that a child, a friend, if you're still also in primary, has HIV, then you scared to hug them. I remember being scared to hug someone once I found out that they had HIV. And it was more of the fact that I wasn't aware. The general idea was, no, this person has HIV, and if you hug them, you're going to get it. You know, so already that person was now alienated.
Yeah.
And we only found out later that, no, HIV does not transmit through a hug. It doesn't just, you know, so it's very, yeah.
So education is also a key important factor when it comes to tackling the issue of HIV.
Mm, definitely.
All right. So, yeah, I guess that's where we will leave the conversation. But then, obviously, we will speak to experts in the field.
Definitely, definitely. We have that coming up. So Health Minister Zweli Mkhize launched a new 3-in-1 pill that could help people with HIV suppress their viral load while also averting more than 300,000 new infections through this combination pill in the next 2 decades. The rollout of the one pill a day combination pill called Dolutegravir, will revolutionize the treatment of HIV and could well be a good start to cutting new HIV infections and deaths through the tablet. Most South Africans on HIV treatment already use one of these drugs alongside a third called efavirenz. But there was some resistance from government from bringing in the drug as it can cause birth defects, amongst other things. To discuss his bit further, we have CEO of HAIDS, Dr. Ramnik Aluwalia, who is a registered medical practitioner with the 3 national medical councils of India, Mauritius, and South Africa. He has great clinical and allied healthcare management experience with interests in public health, improving health systems, infrastructure, policy development, and system evaluation. Good evening, Ramnik, and a very warm welcome to the Science Inside.
Hi, ma'am. Thank you, Nandini. So it's an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Firstly, I must say a big congratulations to you on helping and advising on issues of policy. I'm sure your input had some influence in helping government to launch this drug in South Africa, right?
I mean, definitely. I just want to apologize. I'm the CEO of Higher Health. HAIDS used to be the old name, but the Department of Higher Education has looked into this organization, looking at more epidemics beyond just HIV, TB, and STI. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to recollect that I'm the CEO of Higher Health. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Okay. I was part of the task team that was appointed by SANEC and the Deputy President in 2017 when we were developing the National Strategic Plan of South Africa on HIV, TB, and STI. And definitely this drug does come from the outcomes of the strategic plan that South Africa has launched in 2017 to 2022.
Sure. So how was it in probing the government to launch this drug in South Africa? Because we know that it wasn't something that they had encouraged initially because of the defects.
Definitely. See, look, there's a little bit of resistance that we have been started experiencing with the first and the second line regimen of the ARVs that we have been administering across across South Africa, and also Southern Africa in general. But also practically, we also need to find medications through research that can show us best side effects. Mm. And this new innovation of 3-pills-in-1, which obviously the minister has just recently launched, comes at a time when we need a very strong antiretroviral program. The antiretroviral program is just not the program of treating HIV, but it also assists towards preventing new infections. Mm. Remember, if your viral load is decreased because your drugs are effective, then your rate of transmission of the virus to another person also reduces significantly. So automatically, the prevention element also comes. So antiretrovirals are not only for treatment, but also serve as prevention. So it comes at a time when we also need a preventive methodology so that we do not have new infections coming within our country.
Mm, that's very true. Now, speaking about this new drug that has been launched, what are the differences between the Dolutegravir and the 3 drug combination regimen?
Sorry, I didn't hear you. Can you repeat the question?
Yes, I was just asking what the differences are between the new drug, the Dolutegravir, and the 3 drug combination regimen that we all are aware of.
See, DTG, which is Dolutegravir, mm-hmm. Is being now one of the innovative medicine that will replace the regimen in such a way that this will formulate into a three-drug regimen, which it will combine with the two other medications that of the ARV that we always administered, which is tenofovir and lamivudine. So the tenofovir, lamivudine, and DTG as the most common combination will help assist us in as one tablet that can be given once a day, which will help in not only reducing the side effects that we used to have, but we are hoping that this will also reduce the resistance that has been developing both at the first line and the second line of the ARV treatment.
Sure. So you have spoken about the side effects of both of the drugs, the three drug combination as well as dolutegravir. And in terms of the new one that has been launched, where could we see birth defects?
Sorry, the line has been quite a problem. I apologize to the listeners on this issue, but could you just say the last line, please, once again?
No problem. I was asking where we see the birth defects, because with the government discouraging the launch of the new drug, one of the main causes of them not wanting to launch it was because of the birth defects that come with dolutegravir.
There have been certain researchers that have shown that DTG, which is dolutegravir, have found to have birth defects. But there was a recent study from Brazil and many other countries that has shown that it is quite effective and does not conclusively tell us that there are significant birth defects, specifically mothers who are pregnant and are on this regimen. But we also need to understand that every medication in the world has some of the other side effects. It's a chemical at the end of the day. But definitely, this drug has shown that the previous drug, which was Efavirenz, this is far superior drug compared to the previous regimen of Efavirenz when it used to be combined as a three-drug regimen. You're right. We need to closely observe that does this drug develop more side effects. But the new clinical trials have given the government and the Department of Health, as well as the World Health Organization, to clear this drug, to be allowed for countries to look into its regimen. Remember, we're also experiencing, as I said earlier, a lot of drug resistance, a lot of side effects from the previous regimen, which is making our prevention program, our treatment program, quite on a standstill. And this does come at a time when we need a change in our strategy towards a more effective HIV control program.
So now, is the government looking towards phasing out the drugs that are currently in use? And how are they looking towards doing that, if they are?
Just to inform you, I'm not in government.
Of course.
So it's very difficult for me to answer on behalf of the government. But all I can emphasize the fact is that organizations around this country working on HIV, as organizations working on health and wellness, definitely we are very much welcoming this big innovation that the government of South Africa has introduced. It's a bold step. We are challenged by a country with 7.9 million South Africans living with this disease. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of population that is affected. We have to make sure that no new infections come in South Africa. The problem is that we have still a lot of new infections every year being added into our programs of HIV. Our young people deserve a better living than to be HIV. We need to fight this epidemic right from the center. ARVs play a very significant role. ARVs not only help in supporting the HIV-positive people, but also help in preventing the transmission of the virus from HIV-positive or negative people. But together with other preventions like condoms, circumcision, with other innovations around prevention on HIV, ARVs do play a very significant role in preventing new infections. Remember, for us, the bigger battle is to make sure not only our people living with HIV are healthy, mm-hmm. people living with HIV are able to live as long as possible like any other general population. Our biggest fight will be is, does HIV-positive people have less side effects with the medications that they take? But the most important factor is, do we make sure that our South Africa is safe from getting no new infections in the future? Our target is by 2030, we need to reduce no new infections in South Africa. And we have to come to that level of having no new infections in South Africa. We as a country are grappled with lots of young people being infected at very early stage. So we do welcome this innovation. This is a critical innovation. When we experience in a world where the old regime has been having a lot of side effects, old regimes have a lot of resistance being built up, and that is really disturbing our ERV program.
True. I agree with you there, Doctor. Now, these new 3-in-1 pills, are they more expensive than the older drugs?
See, at the end of the day, the government is going to provide it at no cost to our people. So the expense to the government will obviously be determined by how they are working with the pharmaceuticals around the production of these medications. I'm not in that field, so it's very difficult for me to answer such a question. But all I'm trying to say to you is it's again still a very bold decision, and I'm sure the cost will be engaged by the department in its own way.
Sure. No, I hear you, Doctor. And I know it is said to be a better... that it is said to be a better drug than the ones currently on our shelves because patients on DTG are less likely to develop resistance to the drug. How is this so?
Remember, the trials have shown that this is a drug which has been come out of some serious clinical trials. It has shown some serious effectiveness around it. WHO has given us a very big go-ahead. The country has looked into it. The scientists have really drilled deeper into it. So scientifically, it's a superior drug. It's been shown as a very effective antiretroviral compared to efavirenz, which was a previous drug. So efavirenz did have a lot of side effects. So this comes at a time when we need our population on ARVs to have lesser side effects, much more healthier living. And I think that's the right place to go. Science is evolving, so is the pharmaceutical industry. And every time there are research trials, there are trials of more superior quality of antiretrovirals being introduced. And with time, we need to also make sure that we bring that to South Africa.
No, definitely. Now, what difference does it make in terms of drug dispensing and management of the virus?
If you ask me about drug dispensing, did you say the drug dispensing?
Yes, drug dispensing.
As per to what the government has announced that by March 2020, it will be rolled out. Obviously, it depends on how the Department of Health will roll out. As we, as higher education and higher health, we are going to ensure that our ARV clinics and across our institutions of higher education and higher learning are able to receive this drug from the department and be able to roll out to our young students that are on the ARV program at our institutions.
And does it counteract the functioning of certain contraceptives, and if so, which ones?
As such, we are waiting for more study results around this, but as such, it has not shown anything. There are a lot of, you remember, there is a study that comes with the research that shows some negative side effects wrong, for example, with an interaction with the contraceptive, but as such, it's this drug, if it has been now clinically proven, has not shown any kind of disturbance with a contraception program.
Sure. Wow, Doc, this was very informative. So, as a person, how soon can we expect it to be rolled out onto our shelves?
We are waiting for March 2020, as the government has announced, and we really hope that we will be bringing it to our clinics as soon as possible.
Okay, sure. Thank you so much for your time, Doc Ramnik. It was very nice talking to you. That was Dr. Ramnik Aluwalia, who specializes in public health, improving health systems and policy development. He was talking to us about the new dolutegravir, HIV combination pill, which was launched last Wednesday. On the socials, you can find us on Facebook as The Science Inside and tweet us as at VowFM. Use the hashtag Science Inside. Do stay tuned.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Welcome back. You heard it. You're still with The Science Inside. Now listen, HIV has two main types, HIV-1, which is the most common, and HIV-2, relatively uncommon and less infectious. HIV-1 has the main group M, and group N is the one responsible for the global HIV epidemic. Now, within the main type of Group M, there are many genetically distinct subtypes between A and K. Now, tests to diagnose HIV and monitor the level of virus in the body sensitive to the full range of subtypes and the HIV 2 type and its main type of Group O do exist, but may not readily be available in all settings. So HIV, like any virus, has the ability to mutate and change over time. Researchers have found a new HIV strain subtype L, which falls under the HIV group M. It is extremely rare and can be detected by Abbott's current screening system, but it can screen more than 60% of the global blood supply, which is a cause for concern. So tonight, we are joined by the head of the Center for HIV and STIs and previously the deputy director at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases, NICD, Johannesburg, Dr. Adrian Puren. His interests are in virology and with a specific focus on HIV in areas of diagnosis, HIV research and vaccine endpoint studies, as well as programs related to HIV surveillance. A very warm welcome to the Science Inside, Adrian.
Thank you very much, Nombalisa, for that introduction, and good evening to your listeners.
Of course. And I would like for us to talk about the new HIV subtype, which has been under the radar for almost 19 years. Why is it that we have not been able to pick the virus up for that long?
The one thought I did have is that, you know, we screen for viruses, and I think that that's what Abbott does on a routine basis.
Mm-hmm.
And has only really detected, and I think they've only identified two of the new, they call it a subtype, and they had problems, I think, with the third specimen that they thought could yield a third specimen to ensure that. It's possible, you know, when you look at HIV, it's a highly diverse virus,
mm-hmm.
And you've outlined quite succinctly how that level of diversity, for example, in the M group. It's possible that, you know, you may have these other strains, but that they may not necessarily be transmissible, for example.
Mm.
And so, although it is there, the level in which it is in the general population, populations that you sample from, is so rare that you are unable to detect it, or you detect it at such a, you know, ad hoc number in terms of one or two particular cases. And so it could just simply be a dead end. And it hasn't been transmitted, for example, as you know, in South Africa and other parts of Africa, there are mm-hmm. some dominant viruses, so subtype C clade, for example, D in Kenya, and so on. So those have really become the dominant viruses or subtypes in circulation, whereas this particular subtype may be simply there, but at such low levels because it's not easily transmissible, for example.
Sure. So, Doctor, how was it discovered and how does it affect and undermine the available diagnostic of HIV treatment?
So, you raised an important point, and if you look at the history of the diagnostics of HIV, it really has evolved over the years.
Mm.
And my sense is that initially there were certainly problems because the diagnostics that we have today has really been developed in, for example, Europe or the United States, where there was a specific subtype, subtype B, for example, which is still the most dominant virus in circulation in those geographic areas. And that did yield a problem in that they selected a specific set of gene or genes which were highly mutable. And therefore, when you try to apply those diagnostics in, for example, the African setting, you could possibly miss that.
Mm.
But I think the diagnostics has really evolved and become more sophisticated, and it focuses on what we call regions that do not mutate highly, for example. And that's where many of the focus is in terms of diagnostics. So missing it, I think, should not really be a major problem. There may be some risk of under quantifying it possibly, but my sense is that we should be able to develop the necessary diagnostic capability, and I think Abbott has done that. Apparently they've updated some of their diagnostic kit, for example, to ensure that they don't miss this particular virus.
Mm.
My sense is that, you know, using the areas that don't mutate at high rates will certainly allow one to detect these particular subtypes, yes.
Sure. And initially, Doc, how was it discovered? How did it come about? Could you take us through that process?
Yeah. So from what I could gather from my reading is that I think Abbott collects and has an archive of various specimens probably from throughout the world. And they are probably sequencing these particular viruses. And as you know, the technology around sequencing has also certainly evolved to the point where you can get the full genome. And my understanding is that they had sequenced these particular viruses from the DRC, and that's where they discovered them. I think they were from different periods in terms of years that they were able to isolate those specific viruses, or at least two of those particular viruses, and be able to come up and show that it is fairly different from the other subtypes within the M group. But just a slight warning or an alert is that, you know, there is an international convention around recognizing viruses, and so they will probably have to go through that particular system for that to be called the L group within the major group of viruses.
Sure. And how does this new subtype impact on efforts of drug resistance, you know, considering the fact that there has been the new combination pill diluto grave? How has this new strain been viewed and seen in comparison to the efforts?
So my sense again from some of the expert opinion is that in fact the current drug regimens will be equally effective. So I don't think we should be concerned about that at this time, because the mechanisms of the drugs are similar across the major subtype groups.
Okay.
So it should be equally effective regardless of the subtype. So I don't think we should get too concerned about that particular part.
Okay. All right. And what lessons are we learning about this new strain in counteracting the treatment of HIV?
I suppose coming back to the point that we've only really identified two cases, and so my sense is that, again, I think we should not get overly concerned that poses a public health threat. I think we've got, larger challenges that I think we need to address rather than focusing on those two viruses. Yeah.
Sure, Doctor, please do tell us about those challenges.
Certainly. So, as you know, yesterday was World AIDS Day, and that really represents our commemorations after so many decades of having HIV virus in circulation. And yet in South Africa, you know, it's still a major problem. We have about 7.1 to 8.3 million people that are HIV infected. And we have about 5 million people that are currently on treatment. So that leaves us still about, you know, two or so million people that need to start treatment. And of that group, my understanding is that we've only about 90% of those individuals, of that 7.1 to 8 million people, know their status. So we really need to ensure that we provide accessible services in order that we can actually focus and have those persons identified and start them on treatment. Our treatment program as well has its own particular challenges. As I mentioned, we have about 5 million people. Mm. But, you know, there's a large loss of people in terms of to the treatment programs. Again, there are particular challenges around that. And you mentioned a problem when you consider treatment is HIV drug resistance. So that's really a major headache for public health programs. And so the introduction, as you know,
Wednesday.
The Minister of Health announced a new fixed-dose combination that includes a new drug called DTG, dolutegravir. And in combination, it is thought that this drug will really assist us in terms of managing HIV drug resistance, it will also ensure that those who are newly infected with HIV will reach viral suppression far more quicker than the current conventional drug combinations. Obviously, it comes with some side effects.
Mm-hmm.
I think the major one of consideration, but we hope that from the various studies that this risk will be reduced, will be the development of neurotube defects in fetuses,
mm-hmm.
Especially within 6 weeks post-conception. And the other major side effect is weight gain.
Mm.
And sometimes this weight gain can be quite extreme. So I think we're in a good point where we are introducing this particular drug. I know it's been controversial, and it's taken us a long time to reach this particular point, but it certainly offers some hope that we can manage some of the public health problems that we currently are faced with. However, it's again not that straightforward, especially for women that in childbearing age who need to start treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Are they on regular contraception in order for us not to be too concerned about neurotube defects? But if they're young women, and as you know, young women in South Africa are particularly vulnerable, and pregnancy is
mm-hmm.
one outcome of that vulnerability. If they're unsure about what contraception to use or not using it, then the discussion around the use of DTT becomes a bit more complex, a bit more difficult. So certainly bringing together the different fields of access to contraception, and as you know, there have been problems with the availability of contraception in
sure.
public health facilities. So again, that is another challenge. So yes, we have a new drug with all its possibilities, but we also have the challenges that go with it.
Of course. Now, looking at blood and organ donation, how does the nature of the new strain affect transfusions and transplanting aids in treatment of other conditions and diseases?
Good. So that's an important point. So I think we come back to our point about the diagnostics.
Mm.
So my sense is that if the diagnostics is up to date, and that we use the conserved regions, as we call them, of the genes of HIV, then my sense is that we should be able to detect the virus, and that we should prevent any risk of transmission. And or in the sense of either blood transfusion or in the sense of transplantation would be my view at this time. So as you know, in South Africa, we use molecular methods to identify viruses
mm-hmm.
in the blood transfusion setting. And as far as I'm aware, I've not seen any, I'm not aware of a single case since the introduction of that particular technology of transfusion transmission cases at all. There may be one, but I speak to stand to be corrected, but as far as I know, there have been none in South Africa.
Okay, and apart from this new strain being undetectable, what other differences lie between HIV strains that we are aware of in comparison to this one?
So that comes back to the classification of viruses.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to look at the gene that you want to, that will be useful for you to separate out the viruses into different groups. So for example, if you look at let's say 9 or so genes that are on HIV, you choose the most diverse gene, let's say the envelope gene.
Mm-hmm.
And you can then sequence that. And based on the sequences of that particular envelope gene, you can then subgroup the viruses. So you can then subgroup HIV into the three major subtypes or major groups, for example, the M, N, O, and P groups.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at the M group, you can then look at subtypes. Those subtypes are from A to K, and they're also what I call circulating recombinant forms as well. And the differences there are is that when you look at the genetic differences, they're about, say, 25 to 30% different from each other. And then within those particular groups, you can then look at it, say, at 25% or less difference, and that gives you the additional subtypes.
Sure. And in your own opinion, Doc, would you say that we are sitting on an added problem to the current one that we are trying to resolve, and especially in South Africa?
My sense is that I think we have a large enough public health problem with HIV. I don't think that the new strain, that has been identified, contributes to that at all.
Sure. All right. No, thank you so much for your time and joining us on the show, Dr. Adrian Pirin. It has truly been such an insightful discussion.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Of course. For you at home, stay listening. We return after the break.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Welcome back. This is The Science Inside. Now, if you're only tuning in now, let me recap it for you on tonight's show. We were in conversation with two HIV specialists, one who is involved in policymaking and public health development, Dr. Ramnik Aluwalia, who spoke to us about the launch of a new HIV drug, dolutegravir, a drug which could revolutionize how we treat HIV and how we manage new infections. But that was not it. We also had a chat with Dr. Adrian Pirin, who specializes in virology and how HIV is diagnosed, vaccine endpoint studies, as well as programs related to HIV surveillance. Thank you to all our guests featured on tonight's show, namely Dr. Adrian Pirin, who is the head of the Center for HIV and STIs, as well as Dr. Ramnik Aluwalia, who is the CEO of HAIDS. Last but not least, our team behind the scenes in production by Bridget Lepere and tech by Kutwane Sirame. You can find The Science Inside on vits.journalism.co.za/science. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. This was our final show for this year. It has definitely been great hosting you, and I would like to wish you well over the festive season. Have yourselves a lovely night.
This is The Science Inside. The Science Inside Podcast.